Christopher Warren Green, the London Chamber Orchestra in the Symphony No. 94, the Surprise Symphony by Haydn.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, broadcasting out of Henry Ford Community College, and thank you for being here and spending some time with us on 89.3 FM. If you'd like to learn more about some of the talk shows that we've got airing here on WHFR, I'd like to fill you in on them. Every Friday afternoon from 1 until 2 p.m., we air what's called the New WHFR Journal. Your host, Jay Koronick, talks about the latest news and views, the 411, as he says, on things happening locally, and every week it's a new series of topics, some opinions, some discussion on larger issues and how they might affect us here locally and so on. It's a very informative and very entertaining program. Again, it's the New WHFR Journal, Friday afternoons at 1 here on WHFR. And finally, we bring the exciting WHFR Forum series of talk shows your way every Saturday morning, 10 until 11 a.m., a series of rotating topics that you will not want to miss. It's the Forum, Saturdays at 10 o'clock.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Stephen Rinella, the author of American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon. We'll also talk with Xavier Helgeson, co-founder of Better World Books, which has kept millions of books out of landfills. And finally, Carl Pope, Sierra Club's executive director, will share his thoughts about President-elect Obama's picks for key environmental positions. In 2005, author and outdoor enthusiast Stephen Rinella won a lottery to hunt a herd of wild buffalo in Alaska. One of only four hunters who managed to find and kill a buffalo that October, he carried the carcass down a snow-covered mountainside and floated it for 4 miles down a whitewater canyon, all the while dodging grizzly bears and suffering from hypothermia. Rinella chronicles this once-in-a-lifetime adventure and the history of this icon in his new book, American Buffalo, In Search of a Lost Icon, and we're thrilled to have him with us today. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Let's start by talking about what first got you interested in buffalo.
Well, the thing that first happened was, it's funny because I was born in one of the few states that, I was born in Michigan, you know, one of the few states that never had a historic population of buffalo or American bison. And I started getting interested when I moved to Montana. And one day I was hiking in the mountains, in the Madison Mountains, at about 9,000 feet above sea level, and I found a buffalo skull, kind of with just a little part of the bone sticking above the surface, and I dug that skull out. And it was kind of like if you walked into a room and found like a bunch of powdered wigs and like feather quill pens. It was just so bizarre to find this thing. You just don't see them around. And from that moment on, I was always kind of infatuated with the animal and its history and its usage by humans.
Now, what is the difference between buffalo and bison? This is a question I've often wondered about. Is it the same?
I know, it kills me. It kills me. There's no, the names are interchangeable. You start to see, it's kind of funny, you start to see the use of the word buffalo by Englishmen in the 1700s. And what they would do is they liked a type of leather, a very thick leather they made jackets out of, and they call these jackets like a buff coat, and it was made with buff leather. And they would run around and call anything that yielded such leather or had the potential to yield such leather, they would call it a buff. So you see where they'd call manatees buff and they'd call moose buff. But eventually the name kind of got hitched on to the bison. And then by around the time of the American Revolution, it was pretty common to see buffalo, and buffalo was the only name used for them. And the spellings varied, but that was it. Then in the late 1800s, early 1900s, taxonomists kind of realized that buffalo had already been given out twice. It had been given to the water buffalo of Asia, and it had been given to the Cape buffalo of Africa. So they thought that they would solve all this confusion by giving them another name, bison, which is just like a Greek word that means like ox-like animal. And it had already been given to an animal in Europe, the wisent.
Well, you've obviously done your research. I mean, you know more about buffalo and bison than I could ever hope to.
They were solving a problem that in my mind didn't even exist. And so now whenever you talk about this, you guys have to talk about what it means. And it's just like they meant to clear up confusion and created confusion. but there is no difference. It just is just two different terms. I like the one because people used it for so long, you know.
Well, let's talk about the animal itself, regardless of if we want to call it buffalo or bison or anything. What were some of the things you learned about this creature? I mean, this is one of the most, you know, the most evocative icons of the early American era. What did you learn about the animal? What was most surprising to you?
The thing that I became most fascinated by and spent a lot of time researching and writing about was the deep history of humans and buffalo in North America. And when people arrived here, when humans arrived here from Siberia, like, you know, estimates vary, 14 or 15,000 years ago, it's one of the things that they were most interested in. And you find that if you could look at what we do know about the animals, what we do know about people, is we don't know what these early individuals' notions of God were or how they conceptualized their landscape, but we do know that they really like to eat this kind of meat. And it's like, in my mind, kind of the true original American meal. And so one of the fascinating things I learned about buffalo is just all the ways in which they've been put to use by people throughout history. And that's also, that putting them to use has also led to an incredible amount of abuse, but it's also led to an incredible amount of just beautiful interactions and beautiful relationships that the humans have with animals. And I also got a really high regard for the animal's survival in the face of horrible circumstances, in the face of bad weather and bad usage by humans, and also its propensity to have accidents and to die in mass in like really freakish ways. And those are kind of the things that...
You can't leave us hanging there with that. Tell us, what do you mean about buffalo dying in massively freakish ways?
Well, it's like you figure that at the time of European contact, there were between 32 and 40 million buffalo in North America.
There were 40 million buffalo in North America?
Yeah. The fashionable guess now is 32 million on the Great Plains. And then some, you know, a handful of millions, some millions scattered to points north, south, east, and west. Right now, if you look at wild buffalo that live in national park, they live on public lands, national park lands and national forest lands in Canada, western U.S., and Alaska. About 3 to 9% die every year from accidents. Accidents including lightning strikes, fires, drowning. And when you figure that you had 40 million, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of accidental deaths every year. And there were people who would come and go to places on the Missouri River, explorers along the Missouri River in the early 1800s, who would in a single day count upwards of 10,000 floating by on the currents that had all drowned when trying to cross swollen rivers. There's a place in Canada near Great Slave Lake that's called the Peace Athabasca Delta, where four times this century, several thousand have been killed in ice floods. They fell off cliffs. They got mired in the mud. There was a time on the Platte River when 2,000 got stuck in the mud and all died there. It's just kind of mind-boggling and like grotesque in this sort of morbid way that, you know, you want to look away, but you can't look away when you're reading these accounts of people running into these freakish occurrences.
How many buffalo are currently in the United States today, down from that original 40 million?
There are right now 500,000 buffalo living in North America. 96% of those are privately owned livestock that are raised either for pleasure or raised for profit, like people selling the meat. The remaining 4% are like, you know, 20,000 animals live wild on national parks and national forest lands and places where they are relatively free ranging and they live with native predators, and they live in natural social structures. So to say how many we have, it kind of depends on your definition. But the animal is said to be genetically recovered from its near extinction, meaning we don't have to worry about running out of buffalo. It's not going to happen. They're saved. But what the challenge now is to give them an ecological recovery, which would be to let them reintroduce themselves or to reintroduce them to the land that they used to inhabit. And it's a peculiar circumstance because we could have as many as we want. Unlike other things that are vanishing, like polar bears, for instance, if we could desire them back all we want, but we're not going to be able to do anything. But all you have to do to bring the buffalo back is to open the gates, and they would be everywhere, you know. So in that way, it's kind of, I'm like very optimistic about the future of the animal.
You know, your book focuses on the importance of this epic animal, and then, you know, you talk about the need to bring back migratory buffalo herds. How do you reconcile this with hunting these iconic creatures?
Well, that is kind of complicated, and it's, you know, obviously something that people want to ask me about. If you look at, the herd that I hunted in Alaska was introduced there. They're not indigenous to that particular area of Alaska. And they were introduced there by a group of hunters who wanted to turn them loose. They were brought up from Montana. And they would never be there for that reason. Unless, you know, they would never be there if it weren't for that reason. The other thing is, there's a herd there that they only allow a limited amount of hunting on. So, for instance, when I hunted in 2005, you had about 200 animals there. And the next year, there were more animals there. So hunting, in a way, in Alaska, allows the animals to be there because it creates a lot of public interest in their well-being. In other areas, what you're looking at is people wind up having a positive impression, or they have a stake in the animal's reintroduction if they can look at it and see some concrete form of return on it, like that it would bring in dollars from sportsmen or dollars from drawings like the one I participated in. And so in that way, it gives kind of an incentive for reintroduction. But it is complicated, and it's something I still kind of struggle with today. Like, how do you kill the thing you love? And I think that humans here, like I said earlier, humans in North America have been admiring and worshiping and killing this animal since the moment we arrived.
Well, it's really been great having you on the show. Good luck with your new book. You've been listening to Stephen Ranella, the author of a new book called American Buffalo: In Search of a Lost Icon. Joining us now is Xavier Helgeson, one of the founders of a nonprofit called Better World Books. Welcome.
Good to be here, Orly.
It's great to have you on the show. So tell us about how you got the idea to start Better World Books.
Well, it all started with some leftover books from my college roommates. I graduated Notre Dame in 2001 in the height of the dot-com crash, and I was looking for a way to make money. And my roommates had left all these beautiful books, engineering books and calculus books, and we tried to sell them back to the bookstore, but they wouldn't give us any money for them, really, which is a familiar experience. So we posted them on a website called half.com, which had just come out. And lo and behold, these books sold for $50, $80, the same book that the bookstore wouldn't even take back. And it made me realize that when you sell a book directly to another student, all those middlemen are cut out, and there's a way to get value out of a lot of more books. So we started thinking, my co-founder and I, what if we could collect a lot of these books? What if we could collect these books from all over the country and get the value out of them? And that kind of drew us to launch the first book drive in 2002.
Now, where does the Better World part of Better World Books come in?
Well, what we really do is we give away that people can give books to their favorite nonprofit. We turn those books into funding because it's hard to ask people to write another check to a nonprofit, but it's really easy to ask people for their books. They probably want to give them to you anyway, just so they know they're going to a good home. And so what we do is we're kind of like the dog pound for all these used books. We gather them all up in one place. We market them to the world through betterworld.com, and we channel the proceeds back to libraries and literacy organizations. So we've raised over $4.5 million for libraries and world literacy orgs.
which makes sense because if you're a student and you have a biology, a college level biology textbook to donate, you can't give that to a third grader for a literacy program, but you can sell it for money and give it back to the kids.
Exactly, exactly. So that book that you originally bought for $140 and the bookstore won't pay you a dime for, you may donate that, and yeah, it may be a little old, but we can probably find another student who'd pay $20 for that. And so then we take part of that $20 and share that with Books for Africa. They ship college-level books to the African continent. And so essentially what you're doing by giving your book is multiplying your effect. You may be giving 10 books to Africa from the one book you drop in the donation bin.
Now, what about other kinds of books besides textbooks? Is this for everything out there?
It is now. We started with textbooks, but we launched a library program in 2004 and launched a community book drive called the Great American Book Drive in just this year, actually. And so now we have every kind of book under the sun. We are probably the largest used bookstore in the world. We are the largest used bookseller through Amazon.com and one of the largest booksellers on eBay. But our best way to sell books is our own website, which is betterworld.com. So that's really where we focus a lot of our energy.
And what about the environmental impacts? How many books are you keeping out of the landfills?
The current count is running in the – it crossed 10 million a while ago and is still accelerating upward. We also pioneered carbon neutral shipping on where we actually went down to the item level and said, what's the carbon impact of shipping a specific book from Indiana to, say, California, and then charge that back to the customer. It usually only came out to a few cents per book, but that added up in the aggregate because it was required. It wasn't like checking the $10 carbon offset box on your airline website. It was a few cents for every purchase, but required like sales tax.
And so when you're saying that you're one of the biggest used booksellers in the country, maybe even in the world, tell us about how that breaks down. So some of the money goes back to nonprofits, some of it goes to you, because yours is not a nonprofit. It's a social venture program, but you're using it to expand the program. So tell us about how that works.
Well, that's a great question. Usually what ends up going back, we target a social profit margin of 5 to 10%. Which means 5 to 10 cents out of every dollar you spend goes directly in the pocket of a library or a literacy organization. So we also build a target profit margin for the business. So we may not have as huge of a profit margin as your mega online bookstore out there, but we absolutely want to be a profitable business and we want to be able to attract investment because we feel that we can do it way better if we're not going and writing the next grant and looking for the next donation check, but we're just selling books for our supper. And that's really all we've ever done. We never took investment when we started. We just literally just used our credit cards to finance the startup and then sold books, got a little money in, sold more books, and we're able to grow. We got investment this year from a group called Good Capital based in San Francisco. We were their first investment, and they're explicitly targeting social and economic profit. So they want to see a business that not only is growing fast, and we're growing about 40% this year, even in the economic slowdown, but they want to see a business that's turning off social profit and environmental profit as well.
Now, how does it work? How can people help out with this? Obviously, they can donate books, but if they wanted to buy a book on Amazon, is there a way to see which of those books are going through you so the profits get channeled back?
The best thing that they can do is switch their online bookstore. So a lot of people kind of go to Amazon as the default. And, you know, Amazon's very good at what it does, but there's a few things that they don't do well, and one of them is used books. So when you buy a used book through there, you're buying it through who knows what company. And you can definitely check and see if Better World Books is one of the sellers. But if it is, Amazon takes a big cut of that, and we don't even offer our best books on Amazon. So the best thing you can do, we sell new books on our website as well at betterworld.com, and we're trying to position ourselves as kind of the conscious consumer's alternative to Amazon or BN.com or one of the big corporate stores, which really doesn't give anything back. And so we think the idea is appealing for a lot of people that buying their books will help fund literacy. So that's the number one thing they can do. The number two thing they can do is check out our website, get involved if you're involved with a library, if you're involved with a college campus. We have high schools working with us now with a partnership called Invisible Children. And in any of those ways, and soon we'll have the Great American Book Drive rolled out all over the country, and then anybody will be able to find a donation spot to drop off their books. So that's what we're working on right now.
What's been the most fun part of this adventure for you so far?
All the books, I think. I don't know if anybody's ever sorted 1,000 books a day, but when you do, you find some of the most interesting things. Also, it's taken me to Brazil, to Malawi, to Zambia, to Tanzania. I got to meet the former First Lady of Tanzania, and it's all through the literacy work of our that People's Bookbind dollars go towards. So that's really exciting to be kind of the ambassador of all these millions of customers and millions of book donors, and kind of go and present the book to a kid in school in Tanzania.
What's the craziest book you ever stumbled upon in your office?
Oh boy, we found one book. I think it was about 4 feet by 5 feet. We had to give it a special shelf, and it was this old time book of maps. These very kind of cryptic maps. We found some pretty perverse pop-up books that I wouldn't like to share. We've also found many people's photographs and other personal items that they've put in the books that again, they probably wouldn't like shared with the public.
Well, how does it actually work when people send in their books directly to you? Do you have a staff in your office that's sorting and then uploading descriptions to the internet, or does that have to go somewhere else to happen?
We touch every book that's donated, and so that means we take in about a used bookstore a day. So you're looking at 40,000 books coming in every day. And by the end of the day, those are all up online for sale. So it's a pretty big operation. It's about 250,000 square feet in Indiana. And just picture an aircraft hangar full of books. And that's basically what we have going. It's an old packaging plant. And so we're in a real post-industrial area. We're about a mile from the Hummer plant. And we've created I think it's over 200 jobs in Indiana at this point. So that's we've been one of the biggest engines of job growth in the northern Indiana area.
Well, I love the idea of the Hummer plant very close by to basically an enormous book recycling effort. So that's great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great having you on the show.
Great to be here.
And again, you've been listening to Xavier Helgeson, one of the founders of an organization called Better World Books. We're here now with Carl Pope, the executive director of the Sierra Club. Welcome.
It's great to be with you, Orly.
Well, Carl, it is a different world out there now than it was for the past 8 years, and President-elect Obama is appointing many new people. Let's talk about some of the environmental figures that we can expect to see and what the Sierra Club thinks about them.
Well, a very exciting new team is going to be taking over in Washington in about 3 weeks. It's been remarkable to see how much talent there really is in this country. How many really wonderful people are willing to serve their country if the president gives them a chance? I guess probably the most spectacular transformation is over at the Department of Energy, where we have as the new Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, who is a Nobel Prize laureate physicist and an experienced manager at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, who has led that laboratory into doing most of the pioneering innovation and energy efficiency work in this country. So we're really putting in charge of the Department of Energy somebody who understands that the high-performance buildings and energy efficiency are, in fact, the key to a sensible national energy policy. This is an enormous contrast with Vice President Cheney, who many years ago said energy conservation may be a personal virtue, but it's not a national energy policy. And Stephen Chu understands it is an energy policy. But that's only the beginning. You've got Lisa Jackson at the Environmental Protection Agency. She also brings a scientific background and an experience as a regulator in New York. At the White House, you've got Carol Browner, who was one of the most aggressive environmental advocates in the Clinton administration, back to coordinate climate policy and deliver on President-elect Obama's promises that America is going to rejoin the world and lead the world on solving the problem of global warming.
And, of course, what's interesting about this is we're coming out of 8 years of an administration that thought they had no use for science, and now we're seeing some of the top scientists in the country taking over scientific
agencies. That's right. It's a very strong signal from President-elect Obama. Tom Vilsack, the new Secretary of Agriculture, has really been a leader in sustainable agriculture. We have a farm policy which is a global disgrace, and I think Vilsack understands that and can make the commitments to change it. And at the Department of the Interior, Senator Ken Salazar is going to have to wade into the Augean stable of corruption and bribery and scandal and really clean up that department. He's going to have one of the most difficult jobs. He's inheriting a mess at the Department of the Interior, whose own inspector general said that except for breaking the law, anything else unethical is business as usual at this Department of the Interior.
Unbelievable.
So we really are seeing a dramatic change. Obama has assembled a team, and he's given them very clear marching orders. He has repeatedly said since the election that a clean energy economy will be at the absolute centerpiece of what his administration is all about. And it's going to be wonderful to watch all this play out. It's a big job, and the country is in big hurt, but I think they've got the right ideas and the right team to deal with it.
What are your hopes for some of the first things that he might be able to do in office to really begin to, A, turn this around, and B, send a clear picture to the American people that we have new priorities in place?
Well, very quickly, he's got some things he could do. He could grant California and 18 other states the right to implement their clean car standards for carbon dioxide. He could make it clear to the public utilities that he's going to use the authority under the Clean Air Act and follow the order from the Supreme Court to start setting emission limits on the amount of CO2 that comes from coal-fired power plants. He ought to send a signal to coal miners that no longer will the administration pretend that when you cut off the top of a mountain and dump it into a river or a stream, that you're not polluting the water and violating the Clean Water Act. And those three things he can just do with executive orders. He doesn't actually even need to go to Congress or issue a regulation. He just needs to make a clear statement of administration policy. And finally, he needs to say to the world that the United States will be getting ready to come to Copenhagen at the end of 2009 with a commitment to reduce America's emissions of greenhouse gases by 2020 by at least 25% below where they were back in 1990. That's what the scientists have said we need, and President-elect Obama has said his administration is going to be driven by the science.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Carl Pope, the Executive Director of the Sierra Club.
It was great to be with you. Thanks.
It's time to ask Mr. Green from the Sierra Club. Dan in Haddonfield, New Jersey asks, "Hey, Mr. Green, does using cruise control save gas or waste it?"
Well, Dan, yes. In general, cruise control does save gas precisely because it maintains a constant speed until you tap the brake and slow down. Cruise control's main virtue is that it prevents involuntary acceleration, especially on long trips on flat roads, like where you start at 60 and somehow wind up at 90 with the highway patrol in hot pursuit. Now, if you set the cruise control at 90 in the first place, it won't do much good because gas mileage falls off rapidly when you get above 55 or 60. I recently took a road trip where I set the cruise control at 55 and got 42 miles per gallon, higher than the car's EPA highway rating of 35 miles a gallon. People keep complaining they're not getting the mileage out of the car that companies claim they should, but the minute you inquire about their driving and maintenance habits, it becomes obvious why their mileage is subpar.
Ask Mr. Green and learn a lot more online at sierraclubradio.org. This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
It slices. It dices. With razor-like edges that never need sharpening. It's not a blender. It's not a set of steak knives. It's Car Windshield. And now, it can be yours. Here's how. Next time you're in a car and the driver's driving recklessly, simply say nothing. That's right. Let them change CDs. Let them text on their phones. Ignore that little voice in your head that's trying to warn you. And you too can experience Car Windshield. Passengers who have tried Car Windshield agree. It's a smash. Car Windshield may not be for everyone, as it can lead to severe side effects and even death. Please consult your physician after you've experienced Car Windshield. Passengers who wish to avoid Car Windshield can do so by following simple steps, like trusting their instincts, speaking up, and telling their friends to slow down.
In the real world, there is no spokesperson to prevent reckless driving. There's only you. Speak up.
Act now. Paramedics are standing by.
This has been a message from the Ad Council. For more information, go to youarethespokesperson.com.
Hi, I'm Bill Keith. On Light from the Underground, I turn the spotlight on songwriters. I'll give you music that crosses genres so that you can hear the widest variety of music. Each week, I look forward to digging through all the new music we've received to find the best new music for you. Some of the artists you'll hear include Peter Case, Soul Live, Over the Rhine, The Bad Plus, and Betty LaVette. But it doesn't stop there. You'll also hear new music from artists making a go of it right here in Michigan. Check out Light from the Underground, Saturdays at 11 a.m. on 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're making waves.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio and Happy New Year. Today, we're going to rerun a show that we did last year interviewing Arlene Bloom, the first woman to climb Mount Everest. We'll hear from Mark Winnie, who will tell us about the surprising growth in farmers markets around the country. And finally, we'll get some green cuisine recipes for organic winter foods from executive chef Annie Somerville. Arlene Bloom has played a groundbreaking role in women's mountaineering. Best known for leading the first American and all-women's ascent of Annapurna, one of the world's most dangerous mountains, Bloom also led the first women's team up Mount McKinley, was the first American woman to attempt Mount Everest, and has played a leading role in more than 20 mountain expeditions worldwide. She has a new book out now called Breaking Trail, A Climbing Life. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Your biography reads as a list of firsts. What gave you the inspiration to break all these barriers, and how did you become a climber?
Well, that's what I spent 20 years trying to answer writing Breaking Trail, because it was very unlikely. I was raised in a very Orthodox Jewish family in Chicago where I wasn't allowed to go to the beach or ride horses or do anything. And I ended up, you know, doing things like leading the first American ascent of Annapurna I, which history has shown actually is the most dangerous of all the 8,000-meter peaks, has the highest fatality rate, and is possibly the most difficult. And I remember being on a narrow, icy ridge on Annapurna all by myself when a picket came out, and I thought I was going to fall off the ridge, thinking, now, how did I ever get here from Chicago? And it was a long search to really try to understand my childhood. I can give you a couple examples. For example, the house I grew up in was really small, and everybody chain smoked, and everybody watched loud TV, and everybody fought. And I would run out of this smoky, noisy house into the cold Chicago winters, and that would make me feel alive. I just liked nothing better than to be out in the cold and the snow and the blizzard rather than in this smoky house. The adults in the house really didn't like each other, so from an early age, I was always keeping the peace, trying to keep everyone moving in the same direction, a skill which has been really useful leading climbing expeditions. And then you asked how I started, and that happened at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. My freshman chemistry class was critical, both in my becoming a scientist and a climber. My lab partner was a very handsome young man from Portland, and we studied chemistry till late one night, and he said, do you want to climb Mount Hood? And he was very handsome, so I said, sure. And at the time, I was out of shape. I'd never done anything physical. We drove to the mountain, got out, and started up the hill, and he said I was gasping so loud he didn't think I'd make it out of the parking lot. But he was very handsome, so I kept gasping, and we kept going. We'd started in the middle of the night, like you do when you climb these volcanoes in the Northwest. And when the sun rose, we were on a glacier, and it was the most beautiful place I'd ever been. And I fell in love with mountain climbing.
I just got chills listening to that story. How did you get from there to Everest?
When I passed my qualifying exams at Berkeley, I heard about an expedition to Denali or McKinley and wrote for the brochure that said women could go as high as base camp and help with the cooking. And that made me decide to just try to do an expedition with all women.
What year was this?
1969.
And so it was unheard of for women to go beyond there.
That was when women weren't allowed to run marathons for their health. Do you know the first woman to run the Boston Marathon had to register with a man's initial, you know, just using her initials. So they thought she was a man. And then they tried to chase her out of the race, but she outran them and finished. Anyway, so we did climb Denali. And we had our leader collapsed unconscious on the summit. It was a real tough, tough climb. And I became the leader. So at age 25, on the summit of Denali, the highest point in North America, I became an expeditionary leader.
A story that you write about at length in your book.
Yeah, because writing the book, you know, is a big breakthrough in knowing what was important. You know, in your life, you do things, you don't really analyze them or think about them. But when I was writing Breaking Trail, I had the time to think about what was important. And I realized the Denali climb was extremely important. It was so early that nobody even knew it had happened or heard about it. 20 years later, I read about the first women's team attempting Denali because it was very early. But it made me realize that, of course, women could climb high mountains. And then a few years later, all the world's highest peaks, 8,000 meters and higher, had been climbed by men, but not a single woman had climbed 8,000 meters. And I just thought, I knew if women could climb Denali and do this tough rescue, we could climb to 8,000 meters. And so that gave me the impetus and the confidence to attempt Annapurna.
How did your Orthodox Jewish family that you grew up with understand or relate to this decision for you to go out there in the 1960s and 70s and conquer peaks?
Well, my family didn't get it. But, you know, they were so worried that when I rode a horse, they were really worried. So they weren't much more worried about Himalayan mountaineering. You know, once they were maxed, they were maxed.
They didn't even know the difference between Annapurna.
Well, they didn't know the danger.
Right.
Yeah, they worried about everything. And if you worry about everything, then when something really requires worrying about, maybe you don't even do it.
You've also mentioned that you hiked the length of the European Alps with your baby daughter on your back. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit more about that experience?
Well, I had a life of dreaming up adventures and doing them. In the early 80s, I walked the whole length of the Himalayas, which was a year-long walk that was just incredible through all of Bhutan, Sikkim, Nepal, and India. And so I kind of had a habit of adventures. And Rob, my partner, he was a sailor who had done long-distance sailing. And we realized once we had a child, life was going to change. So we thought this summer she was 3 to 6 months old and relatively portable, we would do a big adventure. And I didn't think changing diapers on a boat was very fun. So we came up with the idea that we would walk from hut to hut across the European Alps, from starting at the Yugoslavian, Austrian, Italian border, and just going from hut to hut. And it was gorgeous.
And you weren't afraid with your daughter?
No. Well, we didn't. Well, what we were was overburdened. You know, we were worried first-time parents, so we brought every kind of diaper, disposable diaper. We had kid medicines. You know, we had these 50-pound packs, each of us. Or Rob's was about 80 pounds with a baby sitting on top. And it was really hilarious because Europeans usually hike with these itty-bitty little backpacks. And I also tend to hike in tennis shoes. I have really strong ankles. So, like, I walked across the Himalayas in tennis shoes. So we were hiking in running shoes with these big packs, and these Europeans would come up, and they would go, "It is not possible to cross that pass without the boots." And they'd look, and this pack is too big. And then they would see the baby sitting on top. And it was just because nobody'd ever seen a baby in any of these huts before.
Did you ever feel the urge to turn to anyone in these situations and say, "I'm the first American woman to attempt Mount Everest. You can't tell me what it can do."
Well, I think I used that when I wanted to go into the Grand Canyon, and all the easy routes were full, and the only routes that were open were the more difficult routes, and they wouldn't let me have permission. And I think I used that line successfully, and they let me go to the Grand Canyon.
Well, you also, in addition to being a world-class mountain climber, you also have a doctorate in biophysical chemistry. Is that right?
That's right.
And your research, I've read, was very instrumental in helping to ban two cancer-causing chemicals. So I'm wondering, how do you compare your life in the lab with all of the time that you spent climbing?
Well, 30 years ago, I wrote a lead article for Science magazine saying that the flame retardant that was used in all the children's sleepwear in the country caused mutations, changes in bacteria, and I thought it would be cancer-causing. And it was cancer-causing, and we got that chemical, two chemical flame retardants banned from children's sleepwear in about 4 months. So in the 70s, we actually were able to get five different chemicals that are in the flame retardant family all banned. Since 1980, a total of four chemicals have been banned by TSCA. Our toxics program in America is broken. We cannot regulate chemicals. And most people don't realize this, but untested chemicals are in consumer products. There's no labeling. Even the government can't find out. And so I just recently went back to chemistry and discovered that the very chemical I had gotten banned from children's sleepwear is now the major fire retardant in furniture in California. And it's up to 10% of the weight of the foam in the furniture. It's funny how 30 years later, I'm doing exactly the same thing. And I think people need to know about it. And I think our laws need to, our toxics policy needs to be fixed.
Well, your life continues to be an inspiration to all of us. And I would encourage readers to go out there and buy Breaking Trail, A Climbing Life, Arlene Bloom's new memoir about her experiences on some of the world's highest mountains and beyond. It's time now for some green living tips with Jennifer Adam from Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks.
Today, we are going to talk about how to pick your poison. So in other words, we need to know where we should buy our gas. Now, a lot of us try to cut back on our gas consumption, but if we're on the highway and we need to buy something, which companies are the least worst for us to stop and refuel?
Well, it's never a choice you can feel 100% good about, but there are some significant differences between oil companies. Basically, the things that oil companies do related to the environment break down to four categories, and that's their direct environmental and human rights abuses, things like oil spills and building pipelines through communities. There's their toxic releases from their refineries, which are often in the United States, and how much pollution do they create for each barrel of oil that they process. There's their stance on global warming, whether they've lobbied to put doubt in people's minds that it even exists, or whether they've tried to work within existing processes to address the problem. And there's also their green initiatives, which can be substantial, like investments in renewable energy, or can be kind of greenwashing, like, you know, just giving money to an unrelated environmental group.
So let's start with the bottom of the barrel. Who got the worst rankings?
Well, Sierra gave our worst ratings to ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. Exxon's anti-environmental reputation is really pretty well known. Up until just a couple weeks ago, they were still actively questioning whether global warming was even real and whether people had anything to do with causing it. They haven't paid up in full for the damages that they created with the Valdez spill in Alaska. That was 17 years ago. And they really have a troubling human rights history, as well as the problems with they've been fighting to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which the Sierra Club has been fighting to save. Conoco is the third worst polluter in the United States. That's of all companies, not just oil companies. And they've had major violations at their drilling sites in Alaska.
So what about the better companies? If we know we have to avoid ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, where should we stop for gas?
Well, there's a small company called Sunoco that comes off looking pretty good, but they don't do their own oil drilling and exploration, so there are less opportunities for them to have black marks on their record. We decided that BP was our best or least worst choice of the big companies. They have been leaders in reducing carbon dioxide emissions from their own operations. They've been leaders in supporting Kyoto and backing off on drilling in the Arctic Refuge, and also making a lot of investments in alternative energy, realizing that that's the way of the future. And, of course, they've had bad marks, too. They have a plant in Texas that's really been cited a lot for pollution and had a terrible fatal industrial accident recently. So this just shows how hard it is to make a decision, because you can't really weigh the deaths caused by industrial accidents against those caused by global warming. But there is a lot of information available, and there are substantial differences, so you can educate yourself and make a choice based on your own conscience. Of course, the best thing to do is reduce the amount of gas you have to buy, whether that's by walking, biking, taking transit, carpooling, or just buying a vehicle that uses less gas per mile. You can find out a lot more about the different companies and the records at our website, sierraclub.org/sierra/pickyourpoison.
So again, just to recap, the worst ratings went to ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, and the least worst or the better ratings went to BP. You've been listening to Jennifer Haddam, the Green Living Expert for Sierra Magazine.
I'm Carl Pope, the Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Al Gore won 2 Academy Awards and brought global warming into the living rooms of about 1 billion people, turning it from a complex scientific riddle they could obfuscate into a major part of popular culture and concern. And in Texas, the carbon capital of the country, the coal rush ran head-on into America's capital markets, and the markets won. TXU, the public utility, was struggling to build 11 new pulverized coal-fired power plants and launch a rush to re-embrace coal. It was taken over by a combination of 2 private equity firms, Kohlberg Kravis Robertson Company and the Texas Pacific Group, in what, if approved by the shareholders, will become the largest leveraged buyout in history. But it's not the size of the deal that makes it so newsworthy. It's the fact that the investment bankers insisted on recreating the company they were buying as a green electricity generator. Under the agreement, TXU would stop plans for building 8 of 11 new plants proposed for Texas, kill plans for new coal plants in Pennsylvania and Virginia, back federal legislation that would require reductions in carbon dioxide emissions, and double TXU's spending on energy efficiency up to $80 million a year for the next 5 years. How did this deal come to pass? Wall Street saw the writing on the wall. TXU's plans were opposed by thousands of Sierra Club and other grassroots activists and elected officials across the state. Just last week, a court awarded Sierra Club and other attorneys an injunction that blocked plans to fast-track approval of these coal-fired plants. The mayors of most of the big cities were up in arms. Members of Congress went on record warning the utilities and the coal companies that if they build new coal plants, they will have to pay the cost of the carbon they dump into the atmosphere. Wall Street ran the numbers. Coal just didn't pencil out. As the Washington Post put it, anyone doing an energy investment in today's situation has got to be sensitive to the changes in the attitudes of the culture and the change in the attitudes of the country. I'm Carl Pope, the Executive Director of the Sierra Club.
It's time now for Mr. Green's mailbag. Noreen, out there in Bozeman, Montana, asks, most of the fluorescent light bulbs we've tried buzz noisily. Are there any brands that don't? I'm sending you this message by the light of a deliciously silent, compact fluorescent made by Lights of America, while being mortally annoyed by the buzz of the computer. There are 3 possible reasons for your noise problem. First, the fixture itself might be vibrating in a way that amplifies an otherwise inaudible buzz. Second, a dimmer switch could be causing problems with the bulb's ballast, a device that controls the current flow in fluorescence, the most common suspect for buzz. Most fluorescents are not compatible with dimmer switches. In compact bulbs, the ballast is in the lamp. In many other types of fluorescents, it's in the fixture. Or third, you may simply have gotten stuck with cheap bulbs that have poor components. Now, being a miser, I'm inclined to shun brand name products. If you got a headache from your light buzz, I'd recommend generic supermarket ibuprofen instead of the pricier Advil. But not so with compact fluorescents. You should choose Energy Star qualified bulbs recommended by the EPA. These include big names such as General Electric, Panasonic, Osram, Sylvania, Philips, and Westinghouse, and lesser-known brands such as Fight, MaxLite, and Technical Consumer Products. For a full list, visit energystar.gov or call the toll-free Energy Star hotline at 888-STAR-YES.
We're here with Mark Winnie, the Communications Director for the Community Food Security Coalition, which promotes a regionally based system of growing, processing, and selling food. Welcome, Mark.
Oh, glad to be on the show.
So what does food security mean?
Well, it's used different ways by different people, and we're not always happy with the way it's misused, but for our purposes, we mean that a community or a place has the ability to meet a good share of their own food needs. In other words, they're able to produce food, they have the means to distribute food, you know, through traditional retail outlets or farmers markets or other normal means, and that people are engaged in making sure that there is enough healthy and affordable food for everybody in the community.
You recently wrote an article for Sierra Magazine. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the folks are doing down in Alabama?
Yeah, Alabama is an interesting case in point. One of the big problems we're seeing in this country, unfortunately, is a huge increase in overweight and obesity and illnesses related to that, such as diabetes. Alabama, like other states in the South, unfortunately, have among the highest rates of obesity and diabetes in the country. One thing they're doing is looking at their farming communities and farming sectors as a way to try to prevent obesity through an increased consumption of healthy, fresh food, such as fruits and vegetables. And they're doing that by substantially increasing the number of farmers markets across the state. In 1999, they had about 17 farmers markets, and today they have over 90, which makes them probably one of the, on a per capita basis, one of the best farm marketed states in the country. And, you know, this has been a way to help people who don't have access to good, healthy food, obtain healthy food, because farmers markets are so prevalent and so convenient. And they've done a really interesting thing. They've matched those farmers markets up with a program called the Farmers Market Nutrition Program, which is a federally funded program that provides a pretty small amount of vouchers or coupons to low-income families to go to farmers markets and buy that healthy food directly from farmers. So it's a kind of a great way to bring together a problem with a solution, and you know, help farmers at the same time that they're helping people who are not able to get enough good healthy food.
Talk to us a little bit about the Farm Bill. What can we expect? What should we look out for?
Yeah, this is not enough people know about the Farm Bill, but it is it comes around every 5 or 6 years in Congress, and it is really the most important piece of food and farm legislation that this country develops. And it's scheduled for reauthorization in 2007. And there's many things included in the Farm Bill. It includes, for instance, most of your major nutrition programs like food stamps. It also includes all of the crop subsidy programs. And what we're hoping to do this time around is see if we can't begin to realign the need for better food to address some of the health problems that we have in this country with our food and farm policy. So this is hopefully the opportunity to make this really a food bill as much as a farm bill. And what we mean here is to really start to readjust the numbers, start to reallocate some of the imbalances that we see in the way that we fund programs so that we can put more funding into programs that really do help people.
Do you think that the prospects for getting a good farm bill have changed at all in light of the midterm elections?
Oh, I think they've changed immeasurably. I think we're going to have a Congress that's much more receptive to new ideas, a Congress that's more interested in helping all farmers, not just commodity producers, such as, again, corn and wheat. Though I think it's important to be able to maintain some kind of support for those producers and provide some kind of transition opportunities, I think we're going to be seeing an opportunity and an interest on the part of Congress to look at these health issues and nutrition problems that we have in this country, and to also help fruit and vegetable producers and others who, you know, we think have an opportunity to be able to, you know, make a better connection with consumers.
Well, thank you again, Mark. Once again, we've been talking with Mark Winnie, Communications Director for the Community Food Security Coalition. To read Mark's article on this topic in Sierra Magazine, log on to sierraclub.org/sierra. And now to follow that, we have Executive Chef Annie Somerville from Green's Restaurant in San Francisco to talk about some delicious local food recipes that you can make at home. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what are some great recipes that we should be thinking about right now during this winter season for yummy organic produce?
Well, I think that sautéed greens are a big part of our repertoire. And also, they're so delicious, and they're really nutritious and really good for you. And so on the menu right now, we are sautéing, combining lacinato kale, which is also known as Tuscan kale or cavolo nero or dinosaur kale, with rainbow chard, which are just, it's a beautiful chard which has multicolored stems. And the way we prepare that is, first we parboil, we remove the stems from the kale because they tend to be tough. And you can either cut those off with a knife or just pull them away from the leaves. And then put on a pot of water, bring it to a boil, add a little salt, just to add a little flavor, and then parboil the kale until it's tender. That can be 3, 4, or 5 minutes. Pull it out, drain it, and if you're going to be sautéing it right away, you can just add it right to the pan, or you can cool it down with cold water and just let it drain, and then it'll be ready when you're ready to sauté. And then what I would do would be start with the rainbow chard, remove the stems, separate that from the leaves. And then the great thing about rainbow chard stems is they are crunchy and delicious and really easy to eat. So I just slice those up, saute those with, I call it the trilogy, olive oil. Well, not the trilogy, olive oil, garlic, salt, and pepper in a nice good-sized pan. Get those going because they're crunchy. And then I would add the charred leaves and the kale, which has been parboiled. Add a little more salt and pepper, perhaps a little more oil. Usually there's some water on the leaves from having washed them, and that's good because it adds some moisture to the pan. And then I like to finish it. That might take maybe 3 minutes, maybe four, depends upon how tender the charred leaves are and how tender the lacinato kale is. And when everything is ready, just finish with either some pepper flakes, could be some pine nuts or toasted almonds, pumpkin seeds, and you can also finish with a little lemon or even a splash of sherry vinegar.
Mm, sounds good. I'm getting hungry. All right. Well, you've been listening to Chef Annie Somerville from Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Could you walk by a child living on the streets of your hometown and do nothing? Could you see an abused and abandoned child and just walk by? There are over 1 million kids living and dying on the streets of America. It's unthinkable, but true. There's a generation of lost and homeless kids living on our streets, and we walk by them every day. We don't see them because they're teens and don't look like children, but they're just as vulnerable as any child. Don't walk by. Do something. Go to covenanthouse.org. That's covenanthouse.org. And find out how you can help. Last year, over 65,000 kids, with nowhere else to go, walked through the doors of Covenant House. But over 1 million homeless kids still need your help. Do something. Go to covenanthouse.org and find out how you can help. Because it's not okay for kids to be homeless in America.
Henry Ford Community College has been providing excellence in education for 70 years. As the college celebrates its 70th year, keep an eye on hfcc.edu for upcoming events related to the anniversary, including a special concert on February 28, 2009. Achieve your dreams, and it starts with a visit to hfcc.edu or by calling 1-800-585-HFCC. Start your education at Henry Ford Community College. Your best choice, guaranteed.
And hello, hello to you. This is Lynn, your host of No Boys Allowed, heard right here on WHFR 89.3. That's No Boys Allowed, where we explore the music of female artists who sing, who act, who play musical instruments, who speak quotable quotes. You'll even hear a recipe you might just like. Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 1 until 3 for No Boys Allowed with your host, Lynn, right here on WHFR, the station making waves. Where's that measuring cup?
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn, non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College. Good morning, my name is Bill Keith. It's time for Light from the Underground. Yes, I made it into the studios, braved my way in through what they were warning us was going to be Death Storm 2009. But somehow I survived and made it into the college campus, and then noticed on the door as I was coming in that there was a sign that said the campus was closed. And I said, oh, well, I'm already here. I might as well sit in and do my radio show and enjoy some great music with you this late morning, early afternoon. We'll start things off with some music from John Oates. He's got a CD called 1,000 Miles of Life. Yeah, you heard it right. John Oates from the group Hall & Oates, a new solo album. And I had a chance to talk with him a little over a week ago. And we'll give you a chance to hear some more music from him and that interview, part of that interview, coming up at noon. But here's a little kind of teaser. This song is called I Found Love. On 89.3 WHFR.FM, we're making waves.
I knew a man who thought he had everything. The world was on a string, but now it's come undone. Couldn't see the writing on the wall. Never thought he'd